forget it. Meadows had been part of this thing, the circle of connected events that had gotten him killed, but not Sharkey. He was street trash, and his death here probably saved someone else's life down the line. But he did not deserve this. In this circle, he was an innocent. And that meant things were out of control and there were new rules. For both sides. Bosch signaled with his hand to Sharkey's neck, and a coroner's investigator pulled the body away from the wall. Bosch put one hand down on the ground to balance himself, and stared for a long time at the ravaged neck and throat. He did not want to forget a single detail. Sharkey's head lolled back, exposing the gaping neck wound. Bosch's eyes never wavered. When Bosch finally looked up from the body, he noticed that Eleanor was no longer in the tunnel. He stood up and signaled Edgar to come outside to talk. Harry didn't want to have to shout over the sound of the generator. When they got out of the tunnel, he saw that Eleanor was sitting alone on the top step. They walked up past her, and Harry put his hand on her shoulder as he went by. He felt it go rigid at his touch. When he and his old partner were reasonably away from the noise, Harry said, "So what did the techs have?" "Not a damned thing," Edgar said. "If it was a gang thing, it's one of the cleanest I've ever seen. Not a single print or partial. The spray can is clean, no weapon, no wits." Sharkey had a crew. Used to stay at a motel near the boulevard until today. But he wasn't into gangs, Bosch said. "It's in the files. He was a scammer, you know, with the Polaroids, rolling homosexuals, stuff like that."
"You're saying he's in the gang files, but he isn't in a gang?"
"Right." Edgar nodded and said,
"He still could have been taken down by somebody who thought he was a gangbanger."
Wish walked over to them then, but said nothing. "You know this isn't a gang thing, Jed," Bosch said.
"I do?"
"Yeah, you do. If it was, there wouldn't be a full can of paint in there. No gangbanger's gonna leave something like that behind. Also, whoever painted the wall in there didn't have the touch. The paint ran. Whoever did it didn't know about spraying a wall."
"Come here a sec," Edgar said.
Bosch looked at Eleanor and nodded that it was okay. He and Edgar walked away a few steps and stood near the crime scene tape.
"What did this kid tell you? And how come he was running around loose if he's part of the case?" he asked.
Bosch told him the basics of the story, that they didn't know if Sharkey was important to the case, but somebody apparently did, or couldn't risk waiting to find out. As Bosch spoke, he looked up over the hills and saw the first light of dawn outlining the tall palms at the top. Edgar took a step away and tilted his head up that way too, but he wasn't looking at the sky. His eyes were closed. He eventually turned back to Bosch.
"Harry, you know what this weekend is?" he said. "It's Memorial Day weekend. It's the biggest 3-day showing weekend of the year. Start of the summer season. Last year I sold 4 houses on this weekend, made almost as much as I made all year as a cop."
Bosch was confused by the sudden departure in the conversation. "What are you talking about?"
"What I'm talking about is, I'm not going to be busting my ass on this case. It isn't going to fuck up my weekend like the last one. So what I'm saying is, if you want it, I'll go to Pounds and tell him you and the FBI want to take it, 'cause it goes with the one you're already working. Otherwise, I'm going to work it strictly as a 9-to-5.
"You tell Pounds whatever you want, Jed. It's not my call." Bosch started back toward Eleanor, and Edgar said,
"Just one thing. Who knew you had found the kid?"
Bosch stopped and looked at Eleanor. Without turning around, he said, "We took him off the street. We interviewed him over on Wilcox. The reports went to the Bureau." "What do you want me to say, Jed?"
"Nothing," Edgar said. "But, Harry, maybe you and the FBI there should have looked out for your witness a little better. Maybe save me some time and that boy some life."
Bosch and Wish walked silently back to the car. Once inside, Bosch said, "Who knew?"
"What do you mean?" she said.
"What he asked back there, who knew about Sharkey?"
She thought for a moment, then said,
"On my end, Rourke gets the daily summary reports, and he got the memo on hypnosis. The summaries go to records and are copied to the senior special agent. The tape from the interview that you gave me is locked in my desk. Nobody's heard that. It hasn't been transcribed. so I guess anyone could have seen the summaries. But don't even think about that, Harry. Nobody... Like, he can't be.
Well, they knew we found the kid, and he might be important. What's that tell you? They've got to have somebody on the inside.
Harry, that's speculation. It could have been a lot of things. Like you told him, we picked him up on the street. Anybody could have been watching. His own friends, that girl, anybody could have put out the word that we were looking for Sharky.
Bosch thought about Lewis and Clark. They must have seen them pick up Sharky. What part were they playing? Nothing made sense. Sharky was a tough little bastard, he said. You think he just went walking with somebody into that tunnel? I think he didn't have a choice. And to do that, it maybe took somebody with a badge.
Or maybe somebody with money. You know he'd go with somebody if there was money in it.
She didn't start the car, and they sat in it, thinking. Bosch finally said, Sharky was a message.
What?
A message to us. See? They leave my card with him. They call it in on a no-trace line, and they do him in a tunnel. They want us to know they did it. They want us to know they've got somebody inside. They're laughing at us. She started the car.
Where to?
The bureau.
Harry, be careful with that stuff about an inside man. If you go trying to sell that and it's not true, you could give your enemies all they need to bury you.
Enemies, Bosch thought. Who are my enemies this time? I got that kid killed, he said. The least I'm going to do is find who did it. Bosch looked through the cotton curtains in the waiting room, down at the Veterans Cemetery, while Eleanor Wish unlocked the door to the bureau offices. The ground fog had not burned off the field of stones yet, and from above it looked like a thousand ghosts rising from their boxes at once. Bosch could see the dark gash dug into the crest of the hill at the north side of the cemetery, but still could not make out what it was. It looked almost like a mass grave, a long gouge into the hill, a huge wound. The exposed soil was covered with black plastic sheets.
"You want coffee?"
Wish said from behind him. "Of course," he said. He pulled himself away from the curtains and followed her in. The bureau was empty. They went into the office kitchen, and he watched as she dumped a packet of ground coffee into a filter basket and turned the machine on. They stood there silently, watching the coffee slowly drip into a round glass pot on the heating pad. Bosch lit a cigarette and tried only to think about the coffee that was coming. She waved the smoke away with a hand, but didn't tell him to put it out. When the coffee was ready, Bosch took it black, and it hit his system like a shot. He filled up a second cup and carried both into the squad room. He lit a cigarette off the butt of the first one when he got to his temporary desk. "My last one," he promised when he saw her looking. Eleanor poured herself a cup of water from a bottle she took from her file drawer. "You ever run out of that stuff?" he asked. She ignored the question.
"Harry, we can't blame ourselves for Sharky. If we're to blame, then we might as well offer every person we talk to protection. Should we go up and grab his mother and put her in witness protection? What about the girl in the motel room that knew him? See, it gets crazy. Sharky was Sharky. You live by the street, you die by the street."
Bosch didn't say anything at first. Then he said, "Let me see the names." Wish pulled out the files on the Westland case. She rifled through them and pulled out a computer printout several pages long and folded accordion style. She tossed it on the desk in front of him.
"That's the master there," she said. "Everybody who had a box. There are notes written after some of the names, but they probably are not germane. Most of that was if we thought they were scamming insurance or not."
Bosch started unfolding the printout and realized it was one long list and five shorter lists marked A through E. He asked what they were, and she came around the desk and looked over his shoulder. He smelled the apple in her hair.
"Okay, the long list is, like I said, everybody who had a box. It's an all-inclusive list. Then we did five breakouts, A through E. The first, that's A, is a breakout on boxes rented within the 3 months prior to the burglary. Then B, we did a breakout on box holders who reported no loss at all in the burglary. Then C is the list of dead ends, box holders who were actually dead or we couldn't find because of the changes in addresses or they had given phony information to rent them.
Then the fourth and fifth breakouts are matching lists from the first three. D is anybody who rented a box in the previous 3 months and also reported no loss. E is anybody on the dead-end list who was also on the 3-month list. Understand?
He did. The FBI's thinking had been that the vault had to have been cased by the thieves before the break-in, and that was most likely accomplished by simply going into the bank and renting a box. That way they had legitimate access. The guy who rented the box could go inside the vault any time he wanted during business hours and have a look around. So the list including anybody who rented a box within 3 months of the robbery stood a good chance of also including the scout. Second, it was likely that this scout would not want to draw attention to himself after the robbery, so he might report nothing stolen from his box, so that would put him on the D list. But if he made no report at all, or had given untraceable information on his box rental card, then his name would be on the E list. There were only 7 names on the D list and 5 on the E list. One of the E names was circled. Frederick B. Isley of Park La Brea, the name of the man who had bought 3 Honda ATVs in Tustin. The other names had check marks next to them.
Remember? Eleanor said. I said that name would come up again.
Harry nodded.
Isley, she said. We think he was the scout. Rented the box 9 weeks before the burglary. The bank records show he made a total of 4 visits to the vault during the next 7 weeks. But after the break-in, he never came back, whoever he was, never filed a report, and when we tried to contact him, we found the address was phony.
Get a description?
Not one that would do us any good. Small, dark, and maybe handsome was about as good as the vault clerks could do. We thought this guy was the scout even before we found out about the ATVs. When a box holder wants to see his box, the clerk takes him in, unlocks the little door, and then escorts him to one of the viewing rooms. When he's done, they both take the box back, and the customer initials his box card, kind of like at a library. So when we looked at this guy's card, we saw the initials. FBI. You're a man who doesn't like coincidences. Neither do we. We think somebody was having fun with us. Later, it was confirmed when we tracked the ATVs to Tustin.
Harry sipped his coffee.
Not much good it did us, she said. Never found him. In the debris of the vault after the burglary, we were able to find his box. We printed it and the door. Nothing. We showed the vault clerks some mugs. Meadows was in there, and they couldn't make anybody.
We could go back to them now with Franklin and Delgado, see if one of them was as Isley.
Yeah, we will. I'll be right back.
She got up and left, and Bosch went back to drinking coffee and studying the list. He read every name and address on the list, but nothing jogged his memory aside from the handful of names of celebrities, politicians, and the like that had safe deposit boxes. Bosch was going over the list a second time when Eleanor came back. She was carrying a piece of paper, which she slid onto his desk.
I checked Rourke's office. He already sent most of the paperwork I turned in over to records, but the hypnosis memo was still in his box, so he must not have seen it yet. I took it back. It's useless now, and it might be better if he didn't see it.
Harry glanced at the memo and then folded the page and put it in his pocket.
Frankly, she said, I don't think any of the paper was out in the open long enough. I mean, I just don't see it. And Rourke, he's a technocrat, not a killer. Like they said about you at Behavioral Sciences, he wouldn't cross the line for money.
Bosch looked at her and found himself wanting to say something to please her, to get her back on his side. He could think of nothing and could not understand this new coldness in her manner. Forget it, he said. And then, looking down at the lists, he added, How far did you people check out these people who reported no losses? She looked down at the printouts where Bosch had circled List B. There were 19 names on the list.
We ran each name for criminal records, she began. We did a telephone interview and later a face-to-face. If an agent got weird vibes or somebody's story didn't play well, then another agent would come by unannounced to do a follow-up interview, kind of get another opinion. I was not part of that. We had a second crew who handled most of the field interviews. If there is a particular name there that you're interested in, I could pull the interview summaries.
What about the Vietnamese names on the lists? I count 34 box holders with Vietnamese names. 4 are on the no-loss list, 1 on the dead-end list.
What about the Vietnamese? There's also probably a breakout, if you look for it, on Chinese, Korean, whites, blacks, and Latinos. These were equal opportunity bandits.
Yeah, but you came up with a connection to Vietnam in Meadows. Now we have Franklin and Delgado possibly involved. All 3 were MPs in Vietnam. We've got Charlie Company, which may or may not have a part in this. So, after Meadows becomes a suspect and you started pulling military records of tunnel rats, did you do any further checking with the Vietnamese on this list?
No. Well, yes. On the foreign nationals, we ran their names through INS to see how long they'd been here, whether they were legal, but that was about it.
She was quiet a moment.
I can see what you're getting at. It's a flaw in the way we handled it. See, we didn't develop Meadows as a possible suspect until a few weeks after the robbery. By then, most of these people had already been interviewed. After we started looking at Meadows, I don't think we went back to see if any of the names on the list fit in with him. You think one of the Vietnamese could have somehow been part of this?
I don't know what I'm thinking. Just looking for connections. Coincidences that aren't coincidences. Bosch took a notebook out of his coat pocket and started making a list of the names, DOBs, and addresses of the Vietnamese box holders. He put the four who reported no loss and the name from the dead end list at the top of his own list. He had just finished the list and closed the notebook when Rourke walked into the squad room, his hair still wet from his morning shower. He was carrying a coffee mug that said Boss on the side of it. He saw Bosch and Wish and then looked at his watch.
Getting an early start?
Our witness, he turned up dead,
Wish said, no expression on her face.
Jesus! Where, they get somebody?
Wish shook her head and looked at Bosch with a face that warned him not to start anything. Rourke looked at him also.
Does it relate to this?
He said.
Any evidence of that?
We think so, Bosch said.
Jesus!
You said that, Bosch said.
Should we take the case from LAPD, add it to the Meadows investigation?
He said this looking directly at Wish. Bosch was not part of the decision-making team here. She didn't answer, so Rourke added,
Should we have offered him protection?
Bosch couldn't resist.
From who?
A strand of wet hair dropped out of place and across Rourke's forehead. His face flushed deeply red.
What the hell is that supposed to mean?
How'd you know LAPD had the case?
What?
You just asked if we should take the case from LAPD. How'd you know they had it? We didn't say.
I just assumed. Bosch, I resent what that implies, and I resent the hell out of you. Are you implying that I or someone... If you are saying there's a law enforcement leak on this case, then I will request an internal review today. But I'll tell you right now that if there was a leak, it wasn't from the Bureau.
Then where the hell else could it have been? What happened to the reports we filed with you? Who saw them? Rourke shook his head.
Harry, don't be ridiculous. I understand your feelings, but let's calm down and think for a minute. The witness was snatched off the street and interviewed at Hollywood Station, then dropped off at a public youth shelter. And lastly, you're being followed around by your own department, detective. I'm sorry, but even your own people apparently don't trust you.
Bosch's face grew dark. He felt betrayed in a sense. Rourke could only have known about the tale through Wish. She had made Lewis and Clark. Why hadn't she said anything to him instead of Rourke? Bosch looked over at her, but she was looking down at her desk. He looked back at Rourke, who was nodding his head as if it were on a spring.
Yes, she made the tale on you the first day.
Rourke looked around the empty squad room, obviously wishing he had a larger audience. He was moving his weight from one foot to the other now, like a boxer in his corner, impatiently waiting for the next round to begin so he could deliver the knockout punch on a fading opponent. Wish continued to sit silently at her desk, and in that moment it seemed to Bosch to be a million years ago that they had held each other in her bed. Rourke said,
"Maybe you should look at yourself and your own department before running around making reckless accusations."
Bosch said nothing. He just stood up and headed to the door.
"Harry, where are you going?"
Eleanor called from her desk. He turned around and looked at her a moment. Then he kept walking. Lewis and Clark picked up Bosch's Caprice as soon as it came out of the federal garage. Clark was driving. Lewis dutifully noted the time on the surveillance log. He said,
"He's got a bug up his ass. Better move up on him some."
Bosch had turned west on Wilshire and was heading for the 405. Clark increased his speed to stay with him in the morning rush-hour traffic.
"I'd have a bug somewhere if I'd just lost my only witness," Clark said.
"If I'd gotten him killed."
"How you figure?"
"You saw it. He stuffed the kid in that shelter and went his merry way. I don't know what that kid saw or what he told them, but it was important enough for him to have to be eliminated. Bosch should have taken better care, kept him under lock and key." They went south on the 405. Bosch was 10 cars ahead, now staying in the slow lane. The freeway was thick with a stinking, polluting mass of moving steel.
I think he's going for the 10, Clark said. He's going into Santa Monica, maybe back to her place. Probably forgot his toothbrush. Or she's coming back to meet him for a nooner. You know what I say? I say we let him go and we go back to talk to Irving. I think we can build something on this witness thing. Maybe dereliction of duty. There's enough to get an administrative hearing. He'd at least get bounced out of homicide. And if Harry Bosch ain't allowed to be on the homicide table, then he'll pick up and leave. One more notch on our barrel.
Lewis thought about his partner's idea. It wasn't bad. It could work. But he didn't want to pull off the surveillance without Irving's say-so.
Keep with him, he said.
When he stops somewhere, I'll drop a quarter and see what Irving wants to do. When he buzzed me this morning about the kid, he seemed pretty stoked, like things were getting good, so I don't want to pull off without his say-so.
Whatever. Anyway, how'd Irving know about the kid getting snuffed so fast?
I don't know. Watch it here, he's taking the 10. They followed the gray Caprice onto the Santa Monica freeway. They were now going away from the working city, against the grain, and were in lighter traffic. But Bosch no longer was speeding, and he went past the Cloverfield and Lincoln exits to Eleanor Wish's home, staying on the freeway until it curved through the tunnel and came out below the beach cliffs as the Pacific Coast Highway. He headed north along the coast, with the sun bright overhead and the Malibu Mountains just opaque whispers ahead in the haze.
Now, Clark said, I don't know. Hang back some.
There wasn't much traffic on the PCH, and they were having trouble keeping at least one car between them and Bosch's car at all times. Though Lewis still believed that most cops never bothered to check if they were being followed, today he was making an exception to that theory with Bosch. His witness had been murdered. He might instinctively think someone had been following him, or still was.
Yeah, just hang back. We got all day, and so does he.
Bosch's pace held steady for the next 4 miles, until he turned into a parking lot next to Alice's and the Malibu Pier. Lewis and Clark cruised by. After a half mile, Clark made an illegal U-turn and headed back. When they pulled into the parking lot, Bosch's car was still there, but they didn't see him.
The restaurant again? Clark said. He must love the place.
It's not even open this early.
They both began looking around in all directions. There were 4 other cars at the end of the lot, and the racks on top of them said they belonged to the cluster of surfers rising and falling on the seas south of the pier. Finally, Lewis saw Bosch and pointed. He was halfway to the end of the pier, walking with his head down and his hair blowing 100 different ways. Lewis looked around for the camera and realized it was still in the trunk. He took a pair of binoculars out of the glove compartment and trained them on Bosch's diminishing figure. He watched until Bosch reached the end of the wooden planking and leaned his elbows on the railing.
What's he doing? Clark asked.
Let me see.
You're driving, I'm watching. He's not doing anything anyway, just leaning there.
He's got to be doing something.
He's thinking, okay? There. He's lighting a cigarette. Happy? He's doing something.
Wait a minute.
What?
Shit. We should have had the camera ready.
What's this wee shit? That's your job today. I'm driving.
What's he doing?
He dropped something into the water.
Through the field glasses, Lewis saw Bosch's body leaning limply on the railing. He was looking down into the water below. There was no one else on the pier, as far as Lewis could see.
What did he drop, can you see?
How the fuck do I know what he dropped? I can't see the surface from here. Do you want for me to go out there and get one of the surfer boys to paddle over and see for us? I don't know what he dropped.
Cool your jets.
I was just asking.
Now, can you remember the color of this object he dropped?
It looked white, like a ball, but it sort of floated.
I thought you said you couldn't see the surface.
I meant it floated down. I think it was a tissue or some kind of paper.
What's he doing now?
Just standing there at the railing. He's looking down into the water.
Crisis of conscience time. Maybe he'll jump and we can forget this whole damn thing.
Clark giggled at his feeble joke. Lewis didn't.
Yeah, right. I'm sure that's going to happen.
Give me the glasses and go call in. See what Irving wants to do.
Lewis handed over the binoculars and got out. First, he went to the trunk, opened it, and got out the Nikon. He attached a long lens and then took it around to the driver's window and handed it to Clark.
Get a picture of him out there so we'll have something to show Irving. Then Lewis trotted over to the restaurant to find a phone. He was back in less than 3 minutes. Bosch was still leaning on the rail at the end of the pier. "Chief says under no circumstances are we to break off the tail," Lewis said. "He also said our report sucked ass. He wants more detail and more pictures. Did you get him?" Clark was too busy watching through the camera to answer. Lewis picked up the binoculars and looked. Bosch remained unmoving. Lewis couldn't figure it. What is he doing? Thinking? Why come all the way out here to think? "Fucking Irving, that figures," Clark suddenly said, dropping the camera into his lap to look at his partner. "And yeah, I got a few pictures of him, enough to make Irving happy. But he's not doing anything, just leaning there." "Not anymore," Lewis said, still looking through the binoculars. "Start her up. It's showtime." Bosch walked off the pier after dropping the crumpled hypnotism memo into the water. Like a flower cast on a spoiled sea, it held its own on the surface for a few brief moments and then sank out of sight. His resolve to find Meadows' killer was now stronger. Now he sought justice for Sharkey as well. As he made his way on the old planking of the pier, he saw the Plymouth that had been following him pull out of the restaurant lot. "It's them," he thought. But no matter. He didn't care what they had seen or thought they had seen. There were new rules now, and Bosch had plans for Lewis and Clark. He drove east on the 10 into downtown. He never bothered to check his mirror for the black car because he knew it would be there. He wanted it to be there. When he got to Los Angeles Street, he parked in a no-parking zone in front of the U.S. Administration Building. On the third floor, Bosch walked through one of the crowded waiting rooms of the Immigration and Naturalization Service. The place smelled like a jail. Sweat, fear, and desperation. A bored woman was sitting behind a sliding glass window working on the Times crossword. The window was closed. On the sill was a plastic paper ticket dispenser like they used at a meat market counter. After a few moments, she looked up at Bosch. He was holding his badge up.
"Do you know a six-letter word for a man of constant sorrow and loneliness?" she asked after sliding the window open and then checking her nail for damage.
"Bosch."
"What?"
"Detective Harry Bosch. Buzz me in. I want to see Hector V."
"I'll have to check first," she said in a pouty way.
She whispered something into the phone, then reached to Bosch's badge case and put her finger on the name on the ID card. Then she hung up.
"He says go on back."
She buzzed the lock on the door next to the window.
"He says you know the way."
Bosch shook Hector Villabona's hand in a cramped squad room, much smaller than Bosch's own. "I need a favor. I need some computer time."
"Let's do it."
That's what Bosch liked about Hector V. He never asked what or why before deciding. He was a let's-do-it type of guy. He didn't play bullshit games that Bosch had come to believe everybody in his profession played. Hector rolled his chair over to an IBM on a desk against the wall and entered his password.
"You want to run names, right? How many?"
Bosch wasn't going to bullshit him either. He showed him the list of 34 names. Hector whistled lowly and said,
"Okay, we'll run them through, but these are Vietnamese. If their cases were not worked out of this office, their files won't be here. I'll only have what's on the computer. Dates of entry, documentation, citizenship, whatever's on the computer. You know how it is, Harry."
Bosch did. But he also knew that Southern California was where most of the Vietnamese refugees made their homes after making the trip. Hector started typing in the names with two fingers, and 20 minutes later, Bosch was looking at a printout from the computer.
"What are we looking for, Harry?"
Hector said as he studied the list with him.
"I don't know.
What do you see that's unusual?" A few moments passed, and Bosch thought Hector would say nothing was unusual. A dead end. But Bosch was wrong.
"Okay, on this one, I think you will find he was connected."
The name was Ngo Van Binh. It meant nothing to Bosch, other than it had come from the B list. Bin had reported nothing stolen from his safe deposit box.
"Connected?" "He had some kind of pull," Hector said.
"Connected politically, I guess you would call it. See, his case number has the prefix GL. Those are files handled by our Special Cases Bureau in D.C. Usually SCB doesn't deal with people from the masses. Very political. Handles people like the Shah and the Marcoses, Russian defectors if they're scientists or ballerinas, stuff like that, stuff I never see." He nodded his head and put his finger on the printout. Okay, then we have the dates. They are too close. It happened too fast, which tells me this case was greased. I don't know this guy from Adam, but I know this guy knew people. Look at the date of entry, May 4, 1975. That's just 4 days after the guy left Vietnam. You figure the first day is getting to Manila, and the last day is getting to the States. That leaves only 2 days in between in Manila for him to get approval and get his ticket punched for the mainland. And at that time, I mean, man, they were coming in by the boatload to Manila. No way in 2 days unless he was greased. So what that means is this guy, this Bin, already had approval. He was connected. It's not that unusual, because a lot of people were. We got a lot of people out of there when the shit hit the fan. A lot of them were the elite. A lot of them just had money to pay to make them elite. Bosch looked at the date Bin had left Vietnam. April 30th, 1975. The same day Meadows left Vietnam for the last time. The day Saigon fell to the NVA. And this DOD, Villabona said, pointing at another date. Very short time to receive documentation. May 14th, that's 10 days after arrival, this guy gets a visa. That's too fast for the average Joe. Or in this case, the average no. So what do you think?
I'd say.
He could have been an operative. He could have just had enough money to get him on a helicopter. A lot of rumors still floating around from that time. People getting rich. Seats on military transports going for $10,000. No question, visas going for more. Nothing ever confirmed. Can you pull the file on this guy?
Yeah,
if I was in D.C. Bosch just looked at him, and Hector finally said, all GLs are there, Harry. That's where the people that people are connected to are. Get it? Bosch didn't say anything.
Don't get mad, Harry. I'll see what I can do. I'll make a couple calls. You gonna be around later?
Bosch gave him the FBI's number, but didn't say it was the FBI. Then they shook hands again, and Bosch left. In the first-floor lobby, he watched through the smoked glass doors, looking for Lewis and Clark. When he finally saw the black Plymouth turn the corner as the two IAD detectives finished another circuit of the block, Bosch walked through the doors and down the steps to his car. In his peripheral vision, he saw the IAD car slow and turn into the curb while they waited for him to get in his car and drive off. Bosch did as they wanted, because it was what he wanted. Woodrow Wilson Drive winds counterclockwise around and up the side of the Hollywood Hills, the cracked, patchwork asphalt never wide enough at any point for two cars to pass without a cautious slowing. Going up, the homes on the left crawl vertically up the hillside. They're the old money, solid and secure, Spanish tile and stucco. To the right, the newer houses fearlessly swing their wood frame rooms out over the brown brush arroyos and daisies in the canyon. They are balanced on stilts and hope, and cling as tenuously to the edge of the hill as their owners do to their positions at the studios down below. Bosch's home was fourth from the end on the right side. As he drove around the final bend, the house came into sight. He looked at the dark wood, the shoebox design, seeking a sign that it had somehow changed, as if the exterior of the house could tell him if something was wrong with the interior. He checked the rear view then, and caught the front end of the black Plymouth nosing around the curve. Bosch pulled into the carport next to his house and got out. He went inside without looking back at the tail car. He had gone to the pier to think about what Rourke had said, and in doing so he thought about the hang-up call that was on his phone tape. Now he went to the kitchen and played back his messages. First, there was the hang-up call, which had come in Tuesday, and then a message from Jerry Edgar in the pre-dawn hours today when Edgar had called looking for Bosch to get him out to the Hollywood Bowl. Bosch rewound the tape and listened to the hang-up call again, silently chastising himself for not having picked up on its significance the first time he heard it. Someone had called, listened to his taped message, and then hung up after the first message beep. The hang-up was on the tape. Most people, if they didn't want to leave a message, would simply hang up as soon as they heard Bosch's tape-recorded voice saying he wasn't in, or, if they thought he was home, would have called out his name after the beep. But this caller had listened to the tape and then didn't hang up until after the beep. Why? Bosch had missed it at first, but now thought the call had been a transmitter test. He went to the closet by the door and took out a pair of binoculars. He went to the living room window and looked through a crack in the curtain for the Black Plymouth. It was a half block farther up the hill. Lewis and Clark had driven by the house, turned around and parked at the curb, facing downhill and ready to continue the tale if Bosch came out. Through the binoculars, Bosch could see Lewis behind the wheel, watching the house. Clark had his head back on the passenger seat and his eyes closed. Neither of them appeared to be wearing headphones. Still, Harry had to be sure. Without taking his eyes from the binoculars, he reached over to the front door and opened it a few inches and closed it. The men in the IAD car showed no reaction, no alert. Clark's eyes remained closed. Lewis continued picking his teeth with the business card. Bosch decided that if they had dropped a bug on him, it was transmitting to a remote. It was safer that way. Probably a sound-activated mini-reel hidden on the exterior of the house. They'd wait until he drove away, and then one of them would jump out of the car and quickly collect the reel, replacing it with a fresh one. They could then catch up the tail on him before he got down the hill to the freeway. He walked away from the window and made a quick survey of the living room and kitchen. He studied the underside of tables and electric fixtures, but he didn't find the bug and didn't expect to. The smart place, he knew, was the phone, which he was saving for last. It had a ready power source, and the placement there would provide sound intake of the immediate interior of the house, as well as any conversations that came in through the phone. Bosch picked up the phone, and with a small penknife that was attached to his keychain, he popped the cover off the mouthpiece. There was nothing there that shouldn't be. Then he took the cover off the earpiece. It was there. Using the knife, he carefully lifted out the speaker. Attached behind it, by a small magnet, was a small, flat, round transmitter about the size of a quarter. There were two wires attached to the device, which he knew was sound-activated and called a T9. One wire was wrapped around one of the phone's receiver wires, piggybacking power for the bug. The other wire went into the barrel of the handset. Bosch gingerly pulled it, and out came the backup energy source, a small, thin power pack containing a single AA battery. The bug ran off the phone's juice, but if the phone was disconnected from the wall, the battery could provide power for maybe another 8 hours. Bosch disconnected the device from the phone and placed it on the table. It was now running off the battery. He just stared at it, thinking about what he was going to do. It was a standard police department wire. Pickup range, 15 to 20 feet, designed to take in everything said in the room. The transmission range was minimal, maybe 25 yards at most, depending on how much metal was in the building. Bosch went to the living room window again to look up the street. Lewis and Clark still showed no sign of alert or that the bug had been discovered. Lewis was through picking his teeth. Bosch turned on the stereo and put on a Wayne Shorter CD. He then went out a side door in the kitchen into the carport. He could not be seen from the IAD car. He found the tape recorder in the first place he looked, the junction box beneath the DWP electric meter on the back wall of the carport. The 2-inch reels were turning to the sound of Shorter's saxophone. The Nagra recorder, like the T9, was wired to the house current but had a battery backup. Bosch disconnected it and brought it inside, where he set it on the table next to its counterpart. Shorter was finishing 502 Blues. Bosch sat in the watch chair, lit a cigarette, and looked at the device as he tried to form a plan. He reached over, rewound the tape, and pushed the play button. The first thing he heard was his own voice saying he wasn't there, then Jerry Edgar's message about the Hollywood Bowl, then the next sounds were the door opening and closing twice, then Wayne Shorter's sax. They had changed reels at least once since the test call had been made. Then he realized that Eleanor Wish's visit had been taped. He thought about that and wondered if the bug had picked up what had been said on the back porch. Bosch's stories about himself and Meadows. He grew angry thinking about the intrusion, the delicate moment stolen by the two men in the Black Plymouth. He shaved, showered, and dressed in a fresh set of clothes, a tan summer suit with pink Oxford shirt and blue tie. Then he went to the living room and loaded the bug and recorder into the pockets of his jacket. He took another look through the curtains with the field glasses. Still no movement in the internal affairs car. He went out the side door again and carefully climbed down the embankment to the base of the first stilt, an iron I-beam. He gingerly made his way across the incline beneath his house. He noticed along the way that the dried brush was sprinkled with pieces of gold foil, the beer label he had picked at and dropped from the porch when he was with Eleanor. Once he got to the other side of his property, he picked his way across the hill, going under the next three stilt houses. After the third, he scrambled up the hillside and looked around the front corner into the street. He was now behind the black Plymouth. He picked the burrs off the cuffs of his pants, and then walked casually into the road. Bosch came up unnoticed on the passenger side door. The window was down, and just before he flung the door open, he thought he could hear snoring coming from the car. Clark's mouth was open and his eyes still shut when Bosch leaned in through the open door and grabbed both men by their silk ties. Bosch put his right foot on the door sill for leverage and pulled both men toward him. Though there were two of them, the advantage belonged to Bosch. Clark was disoriented, and Lewis had little more idea what was happening. Pulling them by their ties meant that any struggle or resistance tightened the ties around their necks, cutting off their air. They came out almost willingly, tumbling like dogs on leashes, and landing next to a palm tree planted 3 feet from the sidewalk. Their faces were red and sputtering. Their hands went to their necks, clawing at the knots of their ties as they fought to get air back into their pipes. Bosch's hands went to their belts and yanked away the handcuffs. As the two IAD detectives were gulping air through their reopened throats, Bosch managed to cuff Lewis's left hand to Clark's right. Then, on the other side of the tree, he got Lewis's right into the other set of cuffs. But Clark realized what Bosch was doing and tried to stand up and pull away. Bosch grabbed his tie again and gave it a sharp yank down. Clark's head came forward, and his face rammed the palm tree. He was momentarily stunned, and Bosch slapped the last cuff on his wrist. Both IAD cops were wallowing on the ground then, locked to each other with a palm tree in the middle of the circle of their arms. Bosch unholstered their weapons, then stepped back to catch his own breath. He threw their guns onto the front seat of their car.
"You're dead," Clark finally managed to croak through his swollen throat.
They worked their way up into standing positions, the palm tree between them. They looked like two grown men caught playing Ring Around the Rosie.
"Assaulting a fellow officer. 2 counts, Lewis said. "Conduct unbecoming. We can get you for a half dozen other things now, Bosch."
He coughed violently, spittle hitting Clark's suit coat.
"Unhook us and maybe we can forget this."
"No way. We aren't forgetting a fucking thing," Clark said to his partner. "He's going down like a flaming asshole."
Bosch took the listening device out of his pocket and held it out on his palm for them to see.
"Who's going down?"
he asked. Lewis looked at the bug, recognizing what it was, and said,
"We don't know anything about that."
"Course not," Bosch said.
He took the recorder out of his other pocket and held that out, too.
"Sound-sensitive Nagras, that's what you guys use in all your jobs, legal or not, isn't it? Found it in my phone. Same time, I noticed that you two dummies have been following me all over the city. Don't suppose you guys also dropped the bug on me so you could listen as well as watch?"
Neither Lewis nor Clark answered, and Bosch didn't expect them to. He noticed a small drop of blood poised at the edge of one of Clark's nostrils. A car driving on Woodrow Wilson slowed, and Bosch pulled his badge and held it up. The car kept going. The two IAD detectives did not call for help, which made Bosch begin to feel he was safe. This would be his play. The department had taken such bad publicity for illegally bugging officers, civil rights leaders, even movie stars in the past, that these two were not going to make an issue of this. Saving their own hides came before skinning Bosch.
"You got a warrant saying you can drop a bug on me?"
"Listen to me, Bosch," Lewis said. "I told you we—"
"I didn't think so. Have to have evidence of a crime to get a warrant. Least, that's what I always heard. But internal affairs doesn't usually bother with details like that. You know what your assault case looks like, Clark? While you two are taking me to the Board of Rights and getting me fired for dragging you out of the car and getting grass stains on your shiny asses, I'm going to be taking you two, your boss Irving, IAD, the police chief, and the whole fucking city to federal court on a Fourth Amendment case. Illegal search and seizure. I'll throw in the mayor, too. How's that?"
Clark spit on the grass at Bosch's feet. A drop of blood from his nose fell onto his white shirt. He said,
"You can't prove that came from us, 'cause it didn't."
"Bosch, what do you want?"
Lewis blurted out, his rage turning his face a darker red than it had been when his tie had been tightened like a noose around his neck. Wash started walking in a slow circle around them, so they had to constantly turn their heads or bend around the palm trunk to watch him. What do I want? Well, as much as I despise you two, I don't really want to have to drag your asses into court. Dragging them across the sidewalk was enough. What I want...
Boss, you ought to get your fucking head examined, Clark burst out.
Shut up, Clark, Lewis said.
You shut up, Clark said back.
Matter of fact, I have had it examined, Bosch said. And I still would rather have mine than yours. You'd need a proctologist to check yours out. He said this as he circled close behind Clark. Then he moved out a few steps and continued to make the rounds. I'll tell you what. I'm willing to let bygones be bygones on this. All you have to do is answer a few questions and we're square on this little mix-up. I'll cut you loose. After all, we're all part of the family, right?
What questions, Bosch? Lewis said.
What are you talking about? When'd you start the tale?
Tuesday morning. We picked you up when you left the FBI, Lewis said.
Don't tell him shit, man, Clark said to his partner.
He already knows.
Clark looked at Lewis and shook his head like he couldn't believe what he was hearing.
When'd you drop the bug in my phone?
Didn't, Lewis said.
Bullshit. But never mind. You saw me interview the kid down in Boytown. It was a statement, not a question. Bosch wanted them to think he knew most of it and just needed the gaps filled in.
Yeah, Lewis said. That was our first day on it. So you made us. So fucking what?
Harry saw Lewis pull his hand toward his coat pocket. He quickly moved in and got his hand in first. He pulled out a key ring that included a cuff key. He threw the keys into the car. Behind Lewis, he said, "Who'd you tell about it?"
"Tell,"
Lewis said. "About the kid?"
"Nobody. We didn't tell anybody, Bosch."
"You write up a daily surveillance log, don't you? You take pictures, don't you? I bet there's a camera in the back seat of that car, unless you forgot and left it in the trunk."
"Course we do."
Bosch lit a cigarette and started walking again.
"Where did it all go?"
It was a few moments before Lewis answered. Bosch saw him make eye contact with Clark.
"We turned in the first log in the film yesterday, put it in the deputy chief's box, like always. Don't even know if he looked at it yet. That's the only paper we've done so far. So, Bosch, take these cuffs off. This is embarrassing, people seeing us and all. We can still talk after."
Bosch walked up between them and blew smoke into the center of the huddle, and told them the cuffs stayed on until the conversation was over. He then leaned close to Clark's face and said, "Who else was copied?"
"With the surveillance report? Nobody was copied, Bosch," Lewis said. "That would violate department procedure."
Bosch laughed at that, shook his head. He knew they would not admit any illegality or violation of department policy. He started to walk away back to his house.
Wait a minute, Bosch!"
Lewis called out.
"We copied the report to your lieutenant, all right? Come back."
Bosch did, and Lewis continued.
"He wanted to be kept apprised. We had to do it. The D.C., Irving, okayed it. We did what we were told."
"What did the report say about the kid?"
"Nothing. Just some kid is all. Subject engaged juvenile in conversation. Juvenile was transported to Hollywood Station for formal interview. Something like that."
"Did you ID him in the report?"
"No name. We didn't even know his name. Honest, Bosch, we just watched you, that's all. Now, uncuff us."
"What about Home Street Home? You watched me take him there. Was that in the report?"
"Yeah, on the log."
Bosch moved in close again. "Now here's the big question. If there's no complaint from the Bureau anymore, why is IAD still on me? The FBI made the call to Pounds and withdrew the complaint. Then you guys act like you were called off, but you weren't. Why?" Lewis started to say something, but Bosch cut him off.
"I want Clark to tell me. You're thinking too fast, Lewis."
Clark didn't say a word.
"Clark, the kid you saw me with ended up dead. Somebody did him because he talked to me. And the only people who knew he talked to me were you and your partner here. Something is going on here. And if I don't get the answers I need, I'm just going to lay it all out, go public with it. You're going to find your own ass being investigated by internal affairs."
Clark said his first two words in 5 minutes.
"Fuck you."
Lewis jumped in then.
"Look, Bosch, I'll tell you. The FBI doesn't trust you. That's the thing. They said they brought you into the case, but they told us they weren't sure about you.
They said you muscled onto the case and they were going to have to watch you, make sure you weren't pulling a scam, that's all. So we were told to drop back but stay on you. We did. That's all, man. Now, cut us loose. I can hardly breathe, and my wrists are starting to hurt with these cuffs. You really put them on tight.
Bosch turned to Clark. Where's your cuff key? Right front pocket, he said. He was cool about it, refusing to look at Bosch's face. Bosch walked around behind him and reached both hands around his waist. He pulled a key ring out of Clark's pocket and then whispered in his ear, Clark, you ever go in my home again and I'll kill you. Then he yanked the detective's pants and boxer shorts down to his ankles and started walking away. He threw the keyring into the car.
You bastard!
Clark yelled.
I'll kill you first, Bosch!
As long as he kept the bug and the Nagra, Bosch was reasonably certain Lewis and Clark would not seek departmental charges against him. They had more to lose than he. A lawsuit and public scandal would cut their careers off at the stairway to the sixth floor. Bosch got in his car and drove back to the federal building. Too many people knew about Sharkey or had the opportunity to know, he realized as he tried to assess the situation. There was no clear-cut way of flushing out the inside man. Lewis and Clark had seen the boy and passed the information on to Irving and Pounds and who knew who else. Rourke and the FBI records clerk knew about him as well. And those names didn't even include the people on the street who might have seen Sharkey with Bosch, or had heard that Bosch was looking for him. Bosch knew that he would have to wait for things to develop. At the federal building, the red-haired receptionist behind the glass window on the FBI floor made him wait while she called back to Group 3. He checked the cemetery again through the gauze curtains and saw several people working in the trench cut in the hill. They were lining the earth wound with blocks of black stone that reflected sharp white light points in the sun. And Bosch at last believed he knew what it was they were doing. The door lock buzzed behind him, and Bosch headed back. It was 12:30, and the heavy squad was out, except for Eleanor Wish. She sat at her desk eating an egg salad sandwich, the kind they sold in plastic triangle-shaped boxes at every government building cafeteria he'd ever been in. The plastic bottle of water and a paper cup were on the desk. They exchanged small hellos. Bosch felt that things had changed between them, but he didn't know how much. "You been here since this morning?" he asked. She said she hadn't. She told him that she had taken the mugs of Franklin and Delgado to the vault clerks at Westland National, and one of the women positively identified Franklin as Frederick B. Isley, the holder of a box in the vault, the scout.
"It's enough for a warrant, but Franklin isn't around," she said. Rourke sent a couple crews to the addresses DMV had on both him and Delgado. Called back in a little while ago. Either they'd moved on or never lived in the places in the first place. Looks like they're in the wind.
So, what's next?
I don't know. Rourke's talking about closing shop on it until we catch them. You'll probably get to go back to your homicide table. When we catch one of them, we'll bring you down to work on him about the Meadows murder.
Sharkey's murder, too, don't forget that.
That, too.
Bosch nodded. It was over. The Bureau was going to close it down.
By the way, you got a message, she said. Someone called for you, said his name was Hector, that was all.
Bosch sat down at the desk next to hers and dialed Hector Villabona's direct line. He picked up after two rings. It's Bosch.
Hey, what are you doing with the Bureau? I called the number you gave and somebody said it was the FBI.
Yeah, it's a long story. I'll tell you later. Did you come up with anything?
Not much, Harry, and I'm not going to either. I can't get the file. This guy, Bin, whoever he has got some connections, like we figured. His file is still classified. I called a guy I know out there and asked him to send it out. He called me back and said no can do.
Why would it still be classified?
Who knows, Harry? That's why it's still classified, so people won't find this shit out.
Thanks. It's not looking that important anymore.
If you have a source at state, somebody with access, they might have better luck than me. I'm just the token beaner in the bean counting department. But listen, there is one thing this guy I know kind of let slip.
What?
Well, see, I gave him Bin's name, you know, and when he calls back, he says, sorry, Captain Bin's file is classified. Just like that is how he said it. Captain, he called him. So this guy must have been a military guy. That's probably why they got him out of there and over here so fast. If he was military, they saved his ass for sure.
Yeah, Bosch said. Then he thanked Hector and hung up. He turned to Eleanor and asked if she had any contacts in the State Department. She shook her head no. Military intelligence? CIA? Anything like that? Bosch said. Somebody with access to computer files. She thought a moment and said,
Well, there is a guy on the state floor. I sort of know him from D.C., but what's going on, Harry?
Can you call him and tell him you need a favor?
He doesn't talk on the phone. Not about business. We'll just have to go down there.
He stood up. Outside the office, while they waited for the elevator, Bosch told her about Bin, his rank, and the fact that he left Vietnam on the same day as Meadows. The elevator opened, and they got on, and she pushed 7. They were alone. You knew all along that I was being tailed, Bosch said. Internal affairs.
I saw them.
But you knew before you saw them, didn't you?
Does it make a difference?
I think it does. Why didn't you tell me? She took a while. The elevator stopped.
I don't know, she said. I'm sorry. I didn't at first, and then when I wanted to tell you, I couldn't. I thought it would spoil everything. I guess it did, anyway.
Why didn't you at first, Eleanor? Because it was still a question about me? She looked into the stainless steel corner of the elevator.
In the beginning, yes. We weren't sure about you. I won't lie about that.
What about after the beginning? The door opened on the 7th floor. Eleanor moved through it, saying,
You're still here, aren't you?
Bosch stepped out after her. He took hold of her arm and stopped her. They stood there as two men in almost matching gray suits charged through the open elevator door. Yes, I'm still here. But you didn't tell me about them.
Harry, can we talk about this later?
The thing is, they saw us with Sharkey.
Yes, I thought so.
Well, why didn't you say anything when I was talking about the inside man, when I was asking about who you told about the kid?
I don't know.
Bosch looked down at his feet. He felt like the only man on the planet who didn't understand what was going on. I talked to them, he said. They claimed they just watched us with the kid. They never followed up to see what it was about, said they didn't have his ID. Sharkey's name wasn't in their reports.
And do you believe them?
Never have before. But I don't see them involved in this. It just doesn't fit. They're just after me, and they'll do anything to get me, but not take out a witness. That's crazy.
Maybe they're feeding information to someone who's involved, and they just don't realize it.
Bosch thought about Irving and Pounds again. A possibility. The point is, there is an inside man, somewhere. We know this. And it might be from my side, it might be from yours. So we have to be very careful about who we talk to and what we're doing. After a moment, he looked straight into her eyes and said, Do you believe me? It took her a long time, but she finally nodded her head. She said,
I can't think of any other way to explain what's happening.
Eleanor went up to a receptionist while Bosch hung back a bit. After a few minutes, a young woman came out from a closed door and showed them down a couple of hallways and into a small office. No one was sitting behind the desk. They sat in two chairs facing the desk and waited.
Who is this we're seeing?
Bosch whispered.
I'll introduce you, and he can tell you what he wants you to know about him, she said.
Bosch was about to ask her what that meant when the door opened and a man strode in. He looked to be about 50, with silvery hair that was carefully groomed and a strong build beneath the blue blazer. The man's gray eyes were as dull as day-old barbecue coals. He sat down and did not look at Bosch. He kept his eyes exclusively on Eleanor Wish.
Ellie, good to see you again, he said. How are you doing?
She said she was doing fine, exchanged a few pleasantries, and then got around to introducing Bosch. The man got up and reached across the desk to shake hands.
Bob Ernst, Assistant Deputy Trade and Development, nice to meet you. So this is an official visit, then, not just dropping by to see an old friend?
Yes, I'm sorry, Bob, but we are working on something and need some help.
Whatever I can do, Ellie, Ernst said. He was annoying Bosch, and Bosch had only known him a minute.
Bob, we need to background somebody whose name has come up on a case we are working,
Wish said.
I think you are in a position that you could get that information for us without a great deal of inconvenience or time.
That's our problem, Bosch added. It's a homicide case.
We don't have a lot of time to go through normal channels, to wait for things from Washington.
Foreign national?
Vietnamese, Bosch said.
Came here when?
May 4, 1975.
Ah, right after the fall. I see. Tell me, what kind of homicide would the FBI and the LAPD be working on together?